is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Anna Kogal from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from the AARP magazine and a tiny bit from the New York Times wellness section. One last little article. I know we read a bit last time, and I just wanted to read one more to you that I'm going to start off with regarding sleep. Now, we all know how important sleep is, but this has some pretty specific bits of information that you might not have known. All right, waking up at 4 a.m., is it the key to success or to a cold? Plenty of prominent people like to highlight how early they climb out of bed, but it may not be anything they should be bragging about. Tim Cook, the chief executive of Apple, rises a little before 4 a.m. every day. President Trump wrote in his 2004 book that he needs only 4 hours of sleep a night. David Kush, the former Virgin America CEO, has said that he wakes up at 4:15. And Jennifer Aniston wakes up around 4:30 to meditate, as does Kris Jenner, the same time that Michelle Obama is hitting the gym. Steve Harvey declared, "Rich people don't sleep 8 hours a day." Is the key to success emulating high-profile achievers who are hacking their bodies to increase productivity? Even if capitalism favors early waker-uppers, wake-up times, at least as a badge of honor, there is no data showing that successful people get less sleep. Americans sleep on average less than 7 hours a night, which means that many of us get less sleep than the American Academy of Sleep Medicine recommends. This trend goes back a fair bit further than our recent tech CEOs, said Douglas B. Kirsch, a neurologist and the president of the American Academy of Sleep Medicine. Thomas Edison used to say the same thing, 4 hours are good enough for me. What he left out of the picture is he was a pretty prolific napper as well. Dr. Kirsch said that this early rising trend, propagated by entertainers and entrepreneurs, is deeply troubling. And while some people seem to need less sleep than others, we can't game our body clocks. What happens when we don't get enough sleep? In a 2003 study, researchers at the University of Pennsylvania and Harvard Medical School found that reaction times and performance on cognitive tasks plummet for those getting 4 hours of sleep and for those getting less than 6 hours of sleep. In the study, 48 healthy adults ages 21 to 38 had their sleep chronically restricted. Those who slept less than 6 hours a night produced cognitive performance deficits equivalent to up to 2 nights of total sleep deprivation. In 1999, researchers at the University of Chicago monitored a group who slept only 4 hours a night, a common amount for those who wake up very early, for 6 days in a row. That group quickly developed higher levels of the stress hormone cortisol, higher blood pressure, and produced half the usual amount of antibodies to a flu vaccine. Dr. Charles A. Seisler, a professor of sleep medicine at Harvard Medical School, calls early rising a, quote, performance killer, end quote, because he said, regularly getting for 4 hours of sleep is the equivalent of the mental impairment of being up for 24 hours. Robert Stickgold, a Harvard professor and the director of the Center for Sleep and Cognition at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, said missing just 1 night of sleep impairs memory. Even worse, it biases your behavior, he said, referring to a recent study that monitored 65 healthy people between the ages of 18 and 30 which showed that an impaired mind focuses on negative information when making decisions. But would you still face these issues if you sleep for 8 hours and wake up at 4 a.m.? Maybe. No matter how much sleep you get, if you're not wired for rising at the hour of the wolf, and most of us aren't, according to many sleep specialists, messing with that normal rhythm is still detrimental. Even if you think missing out on just a few minutes, say, getting up just a half an hour earlier, isn't significant, think again. In March, researchers at the University of South Florida and Penn State reported that losing out on as little as 16 minutes a night could have serious job performance implications. When we delay or speed up our internal body clock, it can have the same consequences as not getting enough sleep, a phenomenon known as advanced sleep-wake phase disorder. The reason is that our circadian rhythm tells our brain when to produce melatonin, our sleep hormone. So if you try to wake while your brain is still producing melatonin, you could feel excessive daytime sleepiness, low energy, decline in mood, and cognitive impact, said Lisa Medalli, a behavioral sleep medicine specialist at the University of Chicago Sleep Disorders Center. What if I don't need that much sleep? There are a handful of people who can function adequately on a shorter sleep duration than the average person, but it's very, very rare, said Dr. Medalli. Missing even 2 hours here, an hour there, then having a wildly different sleep pattern over the weekend is the gateway drug to chronic sleep deprivation. Fatigue, irritability, and overall mental confusion are the dangers and symptoms of such deprivation. But you may be able to adjust your schedule. If you are not a morning lark but want to be one, you would need to wake at that 5 a.m. every day, including weekends, and expose yourself to bright light, ideally blue light, for 15 to 20 minutes upon waking, Dr. Medalli said. The trouble is, you have to stick to the new schedule or you'll just get sucked back into the rabbit hole. The benefits of sleeping. Sleep can boost immunity. In a study published in 2015, researchers found that shorter sleep duration was connected to an increased risk of getting a cold. Sleep may be connected to weight gain. If you get less than 7 hours a night, you can put on weight, since sleep loss can adversely impact energy intake and expenditure. That's because, in part, the chemical that makes you feel full, leptin, is reduced, while ghrelin, the hunger hormone, increases. In 2008, professors at the University of Chicago, including Eve Van Cotter, the director of the Sleep Metabolism and Health Center, found a link between sleep loss and an increased risk for obesity and diabetes. A decade later, the university advanced those studies to find that chronic sleep loss can increase the amount of free fatty acids in the blood. That means a metabolism disruption that reduces the body's ability to use insulin to regulate blood sugar. Additionally, there is a connection between sleep and mood. People with sleep issues may also be at higher risk for depression and anxiety, while those disorders can also interfere with sleep. The less you get, the worse you feel. But don't worry, we offer tips for getting more rest. Well, we read some of those last time. But anyway, while some of us seem to need less sleep than others, we can't game our body clocks. And that is what we need to remember. All right. We're on to a few other really good articles. One more about our health. This is from AARP. There's no magic pill for brain health. Don't waste money on brain supplements. All right. The latest report on the Global Council on Brain Health, created by AARP in collaboration with Age UK, finds that there is no convincing evidence to recommend daily dietary supplements for brain health in healthy or older adults, and that the supplements are, quote, likely a waste of your money, end quote. High blood pressure, high cholesterol, and diabetes hurt both heart and cognitive health. So the council concludes that a heart-healthy diet is a brain-healthy diet. Fortunately, there are several other evidence-based steps we can take for brain health, including be social. It is good for our brains, for us, to interact with others, feel connected to them, and take part in purposeful activities. Stay active. Physically active people have a lower risk of cognitive decline. It is preferable to engage in more than one physical activity. Get enough sleep. You got it, sleep. Sleeping 7 to 8 hours each night is related to better brain and physical health in older adults. And be stimulated. Activities such as volunteering, continuing your education, learning a new skill, and doing mentally challenging leisure pursuits all help the brain. There is no magic potion, but there are many paths to maintaining brain health, and we may pay a steep price if we buy into dubious claims and bypass the evidence about what works. To keep our brains healthy, follow the science. For practical tips on what to do for your brain, go to globalcouncilonbrainhealth.org. And there are no spaces among those words, globalcouncilonbrainhealth.org. And you will find evidence-based articles, brain-healthy recipes, and more at stayingsharp.aarp.org. All right. And the Department of Health and Human Services, HHS, and the Food and Drug Administration, FDA, released a two-pronged approach to importing cheaper drugs from abroad. The Safe Importation Action Plan does not include a specific timetable. This is the next important step in the administration's work to end foreign freeloading and put American patients first, HHS Secretary Alex Azar said in a statement. Azar has historically opposed following medications to be brought in from other countries, but this year the president directed him to work with Florida and other states on their plans for drug importation. A provision in the 2003 Medicare Part D prescription drug law already permits importing drugs under certain conditions, but HHS has never approved such a program. And this is from an article entitled, Administration Plan Paves Way for Safely Importing Prescription Drugs. So in our previous article, we didn't want to be using drugs to enhance our brain. But in this one, we talk about how there are safe ways of importing prescription drugs, and consumers could access lower-priced medicines from abroad. Now, we need drugs not for our brains, but for other conditions that we may have. So this is pretty important. Allowing drugs to be safely imported from Canada and other countries is one of the pillars of AARP's Stop Prescription Greed campaign, or Stop RX Greed. campaign, which calls on federal and state officials to find ways to lower the price of life-saving medicines for all Americans. Under one path in the administration's action plan, HHS would issue a regulation outlining how states and pharmacies could get the department's permission to import certain drugs from Canada. State proposals would have to demonstrate that the medicines they want to bring to the United States are safe, that the FDA has already approved these drugs for sale here, and that consumers would save money by buying these medications. Not all drugs would be allowed to be imported. For example, controlled substances, biologics, and certain injected drugs would be excluded. Several states have already passed laws authorizing safe prescription drug importation. Health officials in Vermont, Florida, Colorado, and Maine are working on proposals to submit to HHS. A survey in March by the nonpartisan Kaiser Family Foundation found that 8 in 10 Americans, across all political ideologies, support allowing Americans to buy medicines imported from Canada. The National Academy for State Health Policy has identified a number of widely used and expensive prescription drugs that consumers could save a lot of money on if they could be purchased from Canada. For example, as of 2017, one capsule of Lyrica, a common treatment for nerve damage, cost $6.04 in the United States, compared with 63 cents in Canada. And the price of one tablet of Xarelto, used to prevent and treat blood clots, was $12.44 in the U.S. and $2.11 in Canada. Drug prices in Canada are lower in part because the government helps ensure that pharmaceutical prices are not excessive. The second path the administration's plan outlines would allow drug makers to import versions of their own products that are marked for sale in foreign countries. Pharmaceutical manufacturers would have to prove to the FDA that the drug they are selling abroad is the same as the U.S. version. Okay, here's an article entitled Time-Honored Financial Advice with a Twist. Follow these revised guidelines to boost savings for emergencies, retirement, and investments. And this is from AARP Money Investing. The great thing about rules of thumb is that they can help turn complicated decisions into easy ones. How much life insurance does a person need? What portion of her long-term savings should she put into the stock market? Is there a way to predict the amount of money she'll spend each year in retirement? Answering questions like these could take hours upon hours of research and reflection, or just a few seconds of arithmetic. All right, financial rules of thumb can be a helpful shortcut, says Cheryl Garrett, founder of Garrett Planning Network, a nationwide group of financial advisors. That's sometimes what we really need. Other times, however, those nuggets of received wisdom are a little too simple or just no longer apply. So here's a rundown of the most common money formulas you're likely to come across, along with the reasoning behind them and any revisions they might need to remain useful tools. 1. To protect yourself in case of financial emergencies, keep at least 6 months' worth of living expenses in the bank. The reasoning? An emergency fund is just-in-case money set aside to cover a job loss, a medical problem, car woes, or another costly shock. Financial planners recommend having enough such cash set aside to support yourself for several months, anywhere from 3 to 12, depending on your circumstances. No, don't put the money under the mattress. Instead, keep it in an account you can access quickly, like a savings account, a short-term certificate of deposit, or a money market fund. 6 months, the length of time it commonly takes to find a new job, is generally viewed as a good number, says Dana Levitt of Paragon Financial Advisors in Newton, Massachusetts. The revision. Older working people, who tend to have longer periods of unemployment after a job loss, may want to stash away 12 months of living expenses, if possible, Levitt adds. The same goes for retirees who depend on money pulled from their retirement accounts. Having 12 months of cash on hand reduces the risk of being forced to withdraw money out of investments when stock or bond prices are down, she notes. 2. Before retirement, allocate 50% of your household's annual after-tax income for needs, 30% for wants, and 20% for savings. The reasoning? These ratios help you achieve a three-way balance among everyday essentials, enjoying your life in the present and planning for the future. 50% goes toward things you must have, such as food, housing, and insurance. Other purchases, up to 30% of your spending, are wants, whether they're vacations, meals out, or premium cable channels. The final 20% goes toward savings or, if necessary, debt repayment. The revision? Be realistic and flexible. For many people, needs add up to more than 50% for spending. For example, the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics found that in households anchored by people 65 and older, the basic needs of housing, health care, and meals at home averaged 55% of spending. In these cases, planners caution, it's important to pare back on the wants budget and not forget about debt repayment and savings. 3. Subtract your age from 100. That number is the percentage of your investments you should have in stocks or stock funds. The rest should be in bonds. The reasoning? When you're young, you have a longer investment horizon and are better able to ride out the ups and downs of the stock market. As such, you can shoulder the market risk posed by stocks and stock funds in exchange for the growth potential they offer compared with bonds and bond funds. These bond investments, generally speaking, have lower returns over time, but they supply regular income and can help stabilize an investment portfolio. According to this rule, a 25-year-old should have 75% invested in stocks, but a 75-year-old should only have 25% in stocks, with the rest in bonds. The revision? These percentages may no longer work. People are living longer, and they often need the portfolio growth that stock investments are more likely to provide. Without any adjustment, this rule could cause people to be too conservative, explains financial advisor Sharon Rich of Wamini in Belmont, Massachusetts. If you have enough fixed income to weather a 7 to 10 year downturn in the economy, she says, you can afford to boost the percentage of stocks in your portfolio above what the rule of 100 suggests. 4. Set aside 1% of your home's value each year for maintenance and repairs. The reasoning? Big-ticket maintenance projects such as a roof replacement or house painting aren't annual events, but they're expensive. To make sure you're covered, annually budget 1% of your home's value for these. That's $2,500 a year for a home worth $250,000. If you don't use it 1 year, you can use it the next, says Steve Thalheimer, a Silver Spring, Maryland financial advisor. He likes the 1% guideline, saying that, averaged over time, it should cover major home maintenance expenses. The revision, if you have an older house or if your home is in need of work, you may have to budget more, Thalheimer acknowledges. Garrett recommends 2% of your home's value. Finally, when you buy life insurance, get a policy that pays 7 to 10 times your current annual income upon your death. The reasoning, if you die early, your partner or family will require lots of cash to compensate for the years of earnings you were expected to provide. The revision, rather than using annual income as a guideline, estimate what your survivors need to avoid financial disaster, suggests New York City financial advisor Gary Schatzky, president of objectiveadvice.com. That means making sure they can cover the mortgage payments and the kids' college tuition, pay for health care, and have sufficient income to live. Even if you have no income, you may need insurance to pay to replace the unpaid labor you provide for your family, say caregiving for a child or an older relative. If you're retired or if you don't have any dependents, you might skip life insurance entirely, unless you have a specific estate planning purpose, such as providing for the adult children of your first marriage to avoid conflicts with your younger second spouse. And 6, in retirement, plan for your ongoing expenses to total 80% of your pre-retirement income. The reasoning, once the kids are grown and work-related expenses disappear, the annual cost of living could go down. And though in the past you may have set aside a chunk of your income for retirement savings, after you've retired, well, that line item will likely disappear. The revision, when budgeting for retirement, pay attention to your expenses, not your income. Identify your specific monthly spending needs, then create a cash flow plan to cover them. And leave some wiggle room for spending spikes. Commuting expenses may be gone, but retirees often drop more on travel or need to hire extra help at home. What's more, retirees' expenses tend to vary, often rising in the early years, dropping in the middle years, and then climbing if health issues arise. Look at current expenses closely, advises Rich, who uses a spreadsheet to track spending, and project which annual expenses will go up and which will go down. One thing people often forget to include, taxes generated by retirement plan withdrawals, which become mandatory at age 70 and a half. Well, we have run out of time for today's episode of Modern Maturity. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Anika Gal, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Make it a great week. See you next time.